Welcome to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour. I'm Amy Brown. The Maine Monitor is a nonpartisan independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting, a nonprofit dedicated to delivering high-quality, nonpartisan investigative and explanatory journalism to inform Mainers about issues impacting our state and empower us to be engaged citizens. This program is a collaboration between WERU-FM and the Maine Monitor. Each month, a panel of reporters and editors discuss the stories they've been working on and that you may have read in local newspapers or at themainemonitor.org. Deputy Editor Stephanie McFeeters will be leading today's discussion with reporters Rose Lundy and Josh Keefe. Over to you, Stephanie.
Thank you, Amy. It's been a busy month. I feel like it was just Memorial Day yesterday, and all of a sudden, here we are at the 4th of July. I don't know exactly how that happened, but it's been exciting. There's been a lot going on at the Monitor. Our former reporter, Samantha Hogan, won the Livingston Award for her series on probate courts and Maine's guardianship system, and she got a lot of well-deserved recognition for that series. So that was really exciting. And Rose and I both attended journalism conferences. I was in San Diego for a convening of the organizations that belong to the Institute for Nonprofit News. So I met a lot of other journalists doing nonprofit news across the country, which was very exciting. And Rose was at a gathering of investigative reporters and editors. And we published a lot of great work over the past month. We covered a recovery home in Machias that allows women to bring their children with them. We covered a fight in rural Maine over groundwater extraction and debates over dam removal and a lot more. So I encourage listeners to go to our website and read those stories. But today I wanted to focus on two stories in particular, and we're going to start with Josh, who took us inside Maine's first public defender office, which opened last year in Augusta, and he looked at its goals, its challenges, and the people who are working there. So Josh, you know, tell us, where did the impulse for this story come from?
Why I wanted to look at the public defender's office is because of the problem it's trying to solve, right? Which is the indigent defense crisis in Maine, which is essentially we don't have enough lawyers to represent all the criminal defendants who can't afford their own lawyer. And under the Sixth Amendment of the Constitution, if you're in charge of the crime and you're looking at jail time, you get a lawyer. The state's legally obligated to supply you with one. I'm sure many people know, I mean, this has been a growing crisis for a while. There's somewhere around 900 cases, changes by the day, but 900 cases across the state in which somebody is waiting for a lawyer. Sometimes they're out on bail waiting, but sometimes they're sitting in jail waiting for an attorney. We saw this, obviously, very recently with the Leon Hinckley issue in Auburn, where a judge let out somebody who, against wishes of prosecutors, because he hadn't had a lawyer, and he ended up being involved in a police shooting, and another individual died in a fire as a result of a complicated police standoff. But so the issue is, how do we get more lawyers, and how do we make sure that everyone who's charged with a crime gets a lawyer as part of their constitutional rights? And part of that is Maine is trying to stand up a public defense system. Now, just about every other state does have a public defender system. Maine is the only one without one until recently. There was a sort of group of roving attorneys called the Rural Defense Unit that would go to rural parts of the state and represent clients there. But late last year, the first sort of actually brick and mortar public defender office was opened in Augusta. And it's been, half a year or more. So I was curious about how it was going. And if in that area of the state, if they had made an impact in this indigent defense problem. So they were nice enough to let me kind of hang out there for an afternoon and talk to some of the lawyers there doing the work.
Yeah. So can you tell us what that was like? What's their office like? And I know they let you sit in on a strategy discussion. So I'm curious what you heard there.
Yeah, so they're in a office, sort of an office building in Augusta. Initially, they were in a state building. It's like an old farmhouse that I guess they had to move out of because the floors weren't capable of having multiple people in rooms sitting on them. So they were going to collapse. So they finally found some you know, suitable office space. But yeah, I mean, it looks. You know, sort of like somebody just moved in there. You know, not a lot of stuff on the walls, but they're meeting clients there. And they let me sit in on a strategy session, which is really something that just only happens with public defender's offices. And what I mean by that is typically in Maine, because we haven't had a public defender system, you have individual attorneys kind of doing their own cases, doing their own thing. There's not, you know, big law firms typically don't have, you know, big groups of criminal defense lawyers working on indigent cases. There's just not much money in it. So the public defender's office allows these lawyers to get together and sort of see across a variety of cases, see, you know, trends, see, you know, what kind of plea deals everyone's getting. And it allows them to sort of strategize about public defense, not just in terms of, you know, we're trying to get people lawyers, but how can we improve criminal defense in Maine? So in the day I was there, there was a lengthy discussion about delays at the state crime lab in terms of testing substances believed to be illegal drugs. So what happens is if you're arrested and you're caught with, you know, methamphetamine or fentanyl or whatever else, they send that substance to the state crime lab to actually, you know, verify it is what they think it is. And also to get the exact weight. If you have a bunch of cocaine and it turns out to be, say, half baby powder, the charge might change based on the actual amount of weight that the cocaine is, you know, the amount of illegal drugs. So anyway, there's a big delay. There have been delays in getting those results back from the state crime lab. And what the defense attorneys were basically saying is we're going to start challenging these delays by basically saying, if you don't get, we're going to demand a trial tomorrow. And as a result, you're not going to have the evidence to prove that these were illegal substances. With the idea being that we're going to force the court to, or we're going to force the prosecution to ask for a continuance to try to delay the case, basically playing offense in a way. And, you know, they sort of recognize that, you know, each individual case might not matter, but if we do this over and over again, we can kind of improve, we can force prosecutors to do things differently. We can force the crime lab to get results quicker. And we can improve the criminal justice system.
So they're basically forcing the prosecution to admit that it didn't really have its ducks in order. Is that right?
Yeah, and that's I think what's so interesting about that is I talked to Megan Maloney, who's the district attorney for that part of the state. And is also the president of the Maine Prosecutors Association. And she said, essentially, yeah, they are challenging stuff that we've never had challenged before. And she was happy about it. She said, even though it's making more work for her prosecutors, she loves the fact that basically everyone's game is sort of being elevated here. And she thinks it's healthy for the criminal defense system. And she's saying, yeah, if they keep challenging this, maybe you know, the legislature will put the money into the crime lab to get these results turned around quicker. So it's there's a sense that this kind of defense that isn't just case by case, but kind of takes a bigger look at the criminal defense system or the criminal justice system could, you know, help the whole system get better, make things move quicker, and you know, take a lot of the sort of inefficiencies out of it. So surprising to me here, you know, prosecutor like Megan Maloney say, yeah, we essentially love having them here. We think it's good for everybody.
And does everyone feel that way? I mean, I think you mentioned in your story that they were ruffling some feathers, right?
Yeah, it seems like some of the individual prosecutors, according to the public defenders, you know, sort of are not used to some of this, you know, challenging things here or there. You know, I'm not a lawyer to know exactly kind of the ins and outs of the different motions and everything, but basically, yeah, there was some discussion in the strategy meeting about how to sort of make sure the prosecutors knew it wasn't personal, you know, in terms of the fighting evidence, in terms of zealously representing a client. Like it kind of begs the question to me a little bit about like, well, what were criminal defense attorneys doing before? But it seems like that's a little bit of a concern of theirs to sort of make it clear this is just our job. You know, this isn't anything personal against prosecutors. But but that being said, you know, Megan Maloney's the boss up there, and she's all on board.
Right. Well, and I think to your point about what were criminal defense lawyers doing before, I mean, the Monitor has done a lot of reporting on that. And what we found was that, you know, these defendants were not getting the appropriate defense. You know, they were getting lawyers who had DUIs and who had other issues. And so the system wasn't working. And that's part of what this new project is all about. And this office in Augusta is going to be looked at as a model for other offices that are opening up across the state. Is that right?
That's right. This is the first one. It's in Augusta, I think basically because they had some office space there and they're close to the lawmakers who can come down and sort of see what their money that they've appropriated is buying them. And also because I think Megan Maloney has been pushing for a public defender's office for a while. So I think there was some understanding that that relationship with the prosecutor would be, or the district attorney would be pretty good. But yeah, there is, they've hired two people to be the district public defenders in Bangor and Aroostook. Frayla Tarpinian is the district defender for in Augusta, which covers Kennebec and Somerset counties. But they're getting the leases lined up. They're trying to find office space for those two. And then they're also working on a office in Lewiston and Ellsworth, which should be a little bit further down the line. But as far as the Bangor and Aroostook offices go, I think they're starting, the goal is to have start taking cases next couple months. So it's moving along. But yeah, I mean, what's happening in Augusta, I mean, the Frayla Tarpinian is sort of well aware of this is the case study, you know, this is the blueprint. So, you know, we have to sort of do this well to show that it works. And also, you know, what they do is probably going to be copied everywhere else. So they're sort of setting the precedent for what this office does and the level of representation that they provide.
And in terms of the numbers, I mean, how has it been working so far? What does that look like?
So it has. I mean, based on the numbers that I've seen, you know, they've taken about 600 total cases since they started. That was a couple weeks ago, so it might be a little more than that now. They have a caseload of about 350, 375. And if you think about those numbers in the context of, you know, there's 900 or so cases without attorneys right now, that's a pretty big chunk. If you look at the number of cases without attorneys in Kennebec and Somerset County, I think it's like one or two. The last list I saw, they come out, you know, changes day to day. Whereas there's a few hundred in Penobscot, you know, there's a few hundred in Androscoggin County. So it does seem like they've effectively solved a lot of this problem in Kennebec and Somerset. That being said, there were less sort of to deal with from the beginning there. And it's a little hard to know because they didn't actually start tracking these numbers until the state didn't until I think November of last year. But so it seems like it's working well. Whether this model will be able to sort of, whether state will be able to take this model and sort of drop it in these other areas that are much harder hit by this crisis, I think sort of remains to be seen.
Yeah, that is a big question. Well, why don't we take a quick break and then we'll get back into it.
You're listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU-FM. Stephanie McFeeters, deputy editor at the Maine Monitor, is leading today's discussion with reporters Rose Lundy and Josh Keefe.
Thanks, Amy. So Josh, one of the people you met and you introduce us to in this story is Hillary Knight. Can you tell us a little bit about her and how she joined this office?
Yeah, I think Hillary is sort of she's sort of the best case scenario for the kind of lawyers that this office and this system is hoping to attract. Hillary is from Maine and said she wanted to be a public defender her entire life. As soon as she learned what they were, she understood that that's what she wanted to do. She went out of state for college and then, at some point along the line, realized that there was no public defender's offices in Maine. Went to law school in Massachusetts, ended up working in the public defense system in Massachusetts. Eventually, when she heard that there was going to be a public defender office in Maine, and apparently this is something that she's heard sort of over the years, Maine's going to get one. And it was sort of, I'll believe it when I see it. But when it really seemed like it was happening, she just sort of cold emailed the head of the Maine Commission on Indigent Legal Services, it was named that then. Now it's been changed to the Maine Commission on the Public Defense Services. But emailed him basically being like, this is what I want to do. This is sort of like, this is my dream. This is the job I'm supposed to be doing. And she was hired as part of that initial rural defender unit. She was driving all over the state, having to drive up to Caribou to meet people in jail from southern Maine. Eventually, she was, I think, one of the first two hires at this public defender's office. And, the thing about the public defender's office, I should say, is like, if they just hired people who are already doing this work, it doesn't help the problem because there's no expanded capacity for indigent defense, right? You're just basically having criminal defense lawyers working privately. Now they're working for the government. Nothing's really changed, just sort of the title. So the goal of these offices is to get people who weren't already doing this work to sort of add to the total number of attorneys. And Hillary, although she worked for Pine Tree Legal a little bit in between in Bangor, Hillary was able to, basically take that expertise she had working in Massachusetts and now works in the Augusta office. And there's a few people like that. Like if there's some, I wrote about in a story, another lawyer there who was doing insurance regulation for the last 10 years in Maine. And now moves the office. Now he's a public defender. They have somebody at law school. The idea is you're trying to attract people to this work who weren't already doing it. And the big thing about having a public defender's office is say you're in law school, you get out, you can work for a firm. You can, but if you want to be criminal defense in Maine, indigent defense, there's really no big law firms doing that. So you're probably going to have to go be your own boss. You're going to have to do all the administrative stuff. You have to start your own business. You have to take these cases. And that's really hard, and especially when you're a new graduate. But if you join a public defender's office, you have a team. You have mentors. You have expertise. You're learning from other people. And maybe most importantly, after 10 years of public service after law school, whether it's working for the state or a nonprofit and also public defender's offices, your student loans are forgiven. So that's a huge issue for a lot of people who want to do this work. They know that they're not going to get rich, but if they can work for a public defender's office, they can get their student loans forgiven. And that is a huge incentive as opposed to just sort of going on yourself and trying to do criminal defense.
Right. And we know how much debt people come out of law school with. So that is definitely a factor. One of the things you get into in this story is a decision by the Ninth Circuit that could potentially have some impact here in Maine. Can you tell us a bit about that decision and the questions it raises?
Yeah, so Oregon has a similar problem to what we're going through in Maine. I think I saw one count that there were a few months ago, there's 2,500 cases without an attorney in Oregon. And so what's happened there is there have been lawsuits trying to fix it. You know, there's been legal wrangling over this. But basically what happened is a state judge basically said, listen, if you have somebody in custody for more than 7 days and you don't get them a lawyer, you have to let them out. And that's not, you know, I think that excludes things like murder, but it does. And there's conditions when you get out, right? Either, I mean, you're not just free to sort of do whatever you want, but it's basically you're out on bail. And by the way, if that's 7 days, there is a lot of people in Maine in jail, have been in jail longer than 7 days without an attorney. So anyway, this decision by this judge was appealed, and the federal courts took it up. And at the end of May, the Ninth Circuit ruled, agreed with them, and said, if you don't give people lawyers within 7 days and just keeping them in jail, you have to let them go, again with conditions. And, you know, Maine's not part of the Seventh Circuit, but, you know, that those kind of court decisions have precedent. You know, they have weight. And so, you know, some of the stuff I'm working on right now is seeing some of these defendants go in front of these judges. And there's a lawyer of the day there who doesn't represent, isn't the lawyer for every individual person, but sort of the lawyer who sort of speaks on behalf of everybody who comes up. And they are citing this case. They're saying, hey, the Ninth Circuit said you have to let people out for 7 days. This is a Sixth Amendment violation. Sometimes it's working, sometimes not so much. But yeah, I mean, the fact of the matter is, like, there's not a Supreme Court precedent that says if you go this long without a lawyer, your rights are violated. It's all kind of wishy-washy because we've never been here before, but this is happening in multiple places now. And as a result, you know, something like the Ninth Circuit's opinion, it holds a lot of weight. This is the first time a federal court has ever said anything like this, especially about a state court. So yeah, no, these issues are bubbling up other places, but we're really, the experts I talked to, like, we are really in new territory here with regard to how the Sixth Amendment is applied and how long denial or how long a delay in getting a lawyer becomes essentially a denial of a lawyer. There's not clear answers there.
Yeah. And is that, did this reporting leave you with any new questions, or what are you sort of most interested in looking at now that you've done this reporting?
Yeah. I mean, I guess what I'm trying to figure out now is, you know, there are judges in Maine deciding that Sixth Amendment violations have occurred. So, you know, you can sort of be in jail for a while, no lawyer. But there are judges who are saying, okay, this is you've had your constitutional rights denied, violated, and now we have to do something to fix that. It's called a remedy in legal jargon. And a lot of times that's lowering bail to the point where the person can get out, which is what happened with Leon Hinckley down in Androscoggin County. But, you know, that case has gotten all the, you know, sort of attention, as it should. But this is happening a lot of places, and no one seems to be tracking it. No, there's no lists. These are judges sort of making these decisions orally, and the clerk kind of scribbles down, you know, Sixth Amendment violation. Like, there's not a good sense of how this is going. So what I'm sort of trying to do is figure out how widespread this is, trying to understand, you know, what the sort of evolving standards are about when a Sixth Amendment violation has occurred and then what judges are doing about it. Because in some cases, judges are saying, yeah, it's a Sixth Amendment violation, but, you know, public safety is more important. We're not letting you out. Sorry. You know, your rights have been violated. And other judges seem to take, like Sarah Churchill in Enniskillen County, seem to take the Constitution a little more seriously. Maybe that's too much, but yeah. So, this is all sort of a moving target. This is all kind of happening day by day as we try to figure out like how do we balance constitutional rights versus public safety?
Yeah, it does seem like it's an evolving question, and listeners might not be familiar with what happened in the Leanne Hinckley case. Do you want to just fill people in briefly on what the situation was?
Yes. So on June 12th, Leanne Hinckley is a he went in front of a Judge Sarah Churchill in Lewiston. He had been in jail without an attorney. He had previously served prison time for stabbing a woman, the mother of his child, with the child in the car, and then stabbed a sort of Good Samaritan and tried to come help. He went to jail for that. He's got out. He's violated his terms of release. He's had a long criminal history. He was back in jail. And then a couple of weeks went by without him getting an attorney. And the judge said, basically, he's had a Sixth Amendment violation, Sixth Amendment right violated, lowered his bail to $1,500. He was able to get out. And then a few days later, went to his ex-girlfriend's, I believe, house with a gun. It gets a little hazy about what actually happened, but attacked people in that house. Fire started. A couple buildings were burned down, and then somebody didn't make it out, died, and then Hinckley was with a shootout with police on the roof of one of the buildings, and was killed. I think they're not quite sure yet whether he killed himself or police killed him. And then after that, the Maine Fraternal Order of Police basically released a statement just blasting Judge Churchill, saying that this was on her, that, that these deaths were on her. And then the Maine judicial system, the Maine Supreme Court, they released a statement basically being like, essentially, this is what happens when you don't get people lawyers. Like, it's not just about defending individual rights. It's about making sure the whole system works, and this is sort of falling apart. So it's been a. And then Governor Mills came out and said it criticized the judge for that. So it's been a pretty big mess the last couple of weeks, and it's a really sad. It's a really sad case, but certainly Leanne Hinckley is the case that sort of shows this problem in sort of the starkest terms. But judges are making these calls all across the state because they have to. It's really, in some ways, it's very unfair to them, even though their job is to judge. But the system is supposed to balance individual constitutional rights and sort of the collective safety. And when you take away lawyers, it starts to get out of whack, and judges are having to make tough calls.
Yeah, no, you're right. It is a very sad situation, and it seems to have become a flashpoint. But I think, to your point, it's because there are, these really tough decisions are happening, and there are no easy answers. So I think let's take another quick break, and then we'll get back into it.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU-FM. Josh Keefe and Rose Lundy, reporters for the Monitor, are discussing some of their recent work with Deputy Editor Stephanie McFeeters. You've heard from Josh in this first half of the program. We'll be hearing a little bit more from Rose Lundy coming up.
Thanks, Amy. So yeah, I want to turn to you now, Rose. You recently came out with a piece that you collaborated with ProPublica on. I know you put a lot of time and energy into the story. I think 18 months you spent with them in total. And this piece looks at the failure of Maine's health department to investigate when elderly residents wander away from their care facilities, which is called elopements. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And elopements has nothing to do with marriage. Is that, just to be clear, is that right?
Yes, it's not running away to get married, for sure. It's a technical term for what the state describes as when a resident unsafely wanders from their facility. So like you mentioned, this is part of a much longer series I did with ProPublica looking into Maine's residential care facilities. And those resemble what are commonly known as assisted living facilities, but we call them residential care here. So they are intended to care for older adults and provide less medical care than a nursing home, but still some assistance with activities of daily living and medication management. So I spent a year looking into these facilities, and my first couple of stories looked at the rising need within them. They are intended to be non-medical facilities, but we're finding that people are having higher and higher needs that these facilities have to grapple with and try to meet the needs that they weren't intended to be providing for. And then my second story looked at how the state responded to cases of abuse and neglect in these facilities. And so while I was reporting on those two stories, I got some data from the state that included information on all of the self-reported incidents from these facilities. They are required to inform the state anytime there's certain types of incidents that could include falls or cases of abuse or neglect and things like that. And one that stood out to me were the number of elopements I saw. So we started with that database and then broadened it to try to understand how many other cases might have been out there. And what we found was that there were at least 115 cases in 3 years in which residents unsafely wandered from their facilities. And that's concerning because oftentimes the people who have a tendency to wander are older adults with dementia. And so they can be a pretty vulnerable population. And in some of the specific cases that we saw, they could end up in pretty dangerous situations. We found out about a case in which a woman was found on a very busy road with a walker. She was standing in the middle of the road, disoriented and confused, and a neighbor found her and brought her back to the facility, and the people working there didn't know that she had been missing. And then there was another case where a woman was found in a courtyard in the middle of December at night. She'd been there for 2 hours and without anyone noticing she had gone missing. They found her in the snow and she was rushed to the hospital and actually ended up dying a couple of days later. So they can be really serious incidents. And experts said that the state should investigate every time that there's a case of these incidents to see what went wrong and how they can prevent it in the future. But what we found was we saw how the state had triaged all of the self-reported cases. And we found that in the vast majority of the cases, the state either did no investigation at all or did not visit the facility to do so. So just a limited level of investigation into the cases. And then the state has the option to sanction for these cases. So they could have imposed a fine of up to $10,000, or they could have imposed a conditional license, which could include a halt on admissions, which is also another form of financial sanction, or they could require a plan of correction, that's the lowest level of response the state could do. It's basically they write up all of the violations that a facility was found to have committed, and then the facility is required to fill out a document saying how it will address each of those violations. So the state chose, out of 115 elopements, the state chose to sanction facilities for only two of the cases, the case in which the woman was found in the courtyard and the case in which the woman was found with her walker in the middle of the road. And both times the state chose only to require a plan of correction.
Rose, can I ask how, like, when we say 115, like, how confident are you that that's sort of all of them? Like, these are what's reported? Like, is there, I mean, is there a chance that there's instances aren't being reported?
Absolutely. Yeah. We didn't get to, we didn't go into that too much in my story, but a lot of the people I talked to said these are underreported incidents for sure. And these are primarily self-reported incidents. There's a few that I got from police departments that were in addition to the self-reported, but it's primarily what facilities willingly told the state about. And there were cases in which they had not told the state, but the state found out about it anyway, because somebody else reported it. And so there's almost certainly more of these cases happening than we were able to substantiate.
And you mentioned, you know, that you got this data, but how did you go about finding details about what the cases actually looked like and what happened?
Yeah, that was a really big part of our project, because the initial data didn't have any information about exactly what was reported. So it just said an elopement happened on this day from this facility, and that's all we had. And so I started out by reaching out to police departments and fire departments for a ton of these cases to see if they had responded to the facility on that day. And so I was able to get some police reports for some of these cases that confirmed what happened. Some of them had information, some of them had very little information, but it was able to sort of broaden our understanding of what happened. And then a couple of the cases mentioned that a neighbor had found the resident and brought them back. And so I went door knocking to try to find the neighbors, which is a very common practice in journalism. It can be time consuming, but often is very fruitful. And I actually had two wildly different experiences in the two cases I tried to go door knocking on. So I spent 2 hours in Cape Elizabeth one evening and knocked on, I think, 50 doors was the tally I got to. And I talked to maybe 25 people. So half of them didn't answer. And I left letters telling them what I was working on. And the half that did answer, I would explain who I was and what I was looking for, and wondered if maybe they saw the resident or know someone who did. And not one single person that I talked to in Cape Elizabeth knew what I was talking about. Everyone was super helpful, but it was kind of a shocking level of the opposite of success, which usually I get some luck when I go door knocking. So that was kind of disheartening. But then I went door knocking in Frankfurt for a different case of elopement. And the first door I knocked on, the woman answered, and she said, yeah, I was the neighbor who brought the resident back. I was the one who called the sheriff's office. Happy to talk to you and happy to talk to you on the record. And so she was extremely helpful and ended up being in my story. And so it was pretty interesting seeing the wide range of success that you can have with door knocking, but always a fruitful reporting activity.
Well, I would say you were very lucky, you know, stumbling across that house. But I think that, really it was just the result of your hard work and your willingness to sort of go out there and try to talk to people. And, I think it was good that you were able to find her. And I think she added a lot to your story, right? What was she able to tell you about what happened?
Absolutely. She was the one who had found the neighbor with a walker in the middle of the road during a heat wave. The road, I was able to go out there and see that it was supposed to be 45 miles per hour, but cars were whizzing past. I mean, I was afraid to just pull over and park along the side of the road. And so I couldn't imagine standing in the middle with a walker. I mean, it seemed very, it was alarming to see it myself. And then talking to the neighbor was so helpful, because she told me even more details about what the situation was like and how the resident looked, and was very disoriented and was trying to hitchhike away to go back home. And she added a level of concern and outrage as a community member that you know, of course it's concerning for the residents and the family members, but also it was a perspective of somebody who lived in the community of like, how can this be happening? You know, how can people be allowed to be in dangerous situations like that? So it was enormously helpful to talk to her, and I'm grateful that she was willing to talk so openly about it.
And what did the facility say when she brought the resident back?
She said the woman that she talked to who was on duty didn't know the resident had been missing at all, and gave a standard response of, well, they're free to come and go. And the woman I talked to was like, how is that safe? That's, you know, technically they are free to come and go, but if they are cognitively impaired, you're supposed to be, you know, providing oversight and caring for them. And she said this woman clearly had dementia and was disoriented and should not have been allowed to be on her own, and certainly should have known that she was missing. But the woman on duty said that she was the only one on duty at the time. And the neighbor called it into the sheriff, and the sheriff forwarded it to the Department of Health and Human Services, who did investigate this case, and then ultimately cited the facility for the elopement incident, but also for not having enough people on duty at the time to staff the facility.
And this is an issue that affects people with dementia in particular. Is that right? Or is a particular concern to that population?
Yes. Yeah. Primarily the people who tend to wander, and the cases of elopement that people see are primarily involving people who have dementia.
And the way that the state responded is different from how the federal government has responded to similar incidents at nursing homes. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. So we have about half as many nursing homes as we do the residential care facilities I looked at. And so, but the nursing homes were sanctioned for 11 elopements during a 3-year period, which was more than the state sanctioned. And then there was one case of elopement in which a nursing home in Maine received a $71,000 fine. So the state has the option to fine residential care facilities for elopement, but has chosen not to do it. But certainly the federal government, who regulates nursing homes, has imposed fines for the same types of incidents.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think let's take a quick break, and then we'll get back into it.
This is the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, a collaboration between the Maine Monitor and WERU-FM. This month, Deputy Editor Stephanie McFeeters is talking with reporters Rose Lundy and Josh Keefe about the stories they've been working on.
Rose, I know you worked with a team at ProPublica and did a lot of sort of data crunching for the story. Can you tell us about what that process looked like and sort of what you were looking for in the data?
Yeah, we did a lot of data crunching across the whole project. And certainly this story was no different, but for the whole project, we crunched the number of violations that we found in all of the inspection reports for the roughly 200 facilities. So we created a whole database that had about 700 lines of information about all the different types of violations that these facilities have gotten in trouble for. And that's how we were able to find, for my first story, that there were 200 violations involving medication and treatments. And for my second story, we looked at cases of resident rights violations, which can include abuse and neglect. And we found that there were dozens of those kinds of violations. So for this story, there was only a couple of elopements that resulted in inspection reports, because only a handful of them were investigated to begin with. So we didn't have the same number. It didn't appear in our violations database as much, but we did have a separate spreadsheet of all the self-reported incidents from the facilities themselves. And we were able to break that out into the types of incidents they reported themselves. And we were able to see the number of elopements that were reported and then how the state triaged them. And so they could triage it as a high priority incident to be looked into, medium priority, low priority. Desk review, it was an option, which is means they would call and try to get more information, or no action. And so that's how we were able to say that the vast majority of cases, they opted for no action, and or they did a very preliminary investigation from the office without visiting the facility itself.
Hmm. And I know you did, you spent a lot of time fact-checking the article as well. Can you talk us through that process?
Yeah, the fact-checking process is extensive for a long series like this. We always do, at the Monitor, we always do our own fact-checking. It's a big part of the reporting. But it was even more crucial for this story to make sure that we, after spending months looking into it, that everything that I said in the story, I could stand behind. So the process with ProPublica was fact-checking every single sentence in the story and down to the word sometimes. So I had a separate document where every single sentence, I had a hyperlink to either the interview or the, you know, the source document or the data findings. I could justify every single sentence and go back and check and make sure it's word perfect and it's exactly justified with the reporting I had done. So that was a pretty extensive process. And you also have to go down to even the level of the word choice that you make. You know, if you say so-and-so was surprised by the findings, but you're not quoting, the person didn't specifically say, "I am surprised." You have to go back and look at the exact words that they said and be like, can I justify that they were surprised and not some other word? And so if they say, "These findings I didn't know about and they are alarming and concerning," like, well, maybe you can say, yeah, she was surprised by the findings. So it's a very extensive process, but it's well worth it to make sure that you are quadruple checking every single thing you say in the story. And you can stand behind it if anybody ever has any questions about how you found what you found.
Yeah, I do think it's a very important part of the process. And I don't think it's something that everyone realizes we do. And I actually, you know, before I was at the Monitor, I worked at a magazine as a fact checker, and my job was just fact checking other people's reporting. So I basically would call back all their sources and I would say, well, the reporter says you were sitting on a blue couch and you were wearing corduroy pants and there was a parrot, and they were like, no, it was a parakeet, not a parrot. So that was my work. And so I'm always interested to hear about how other people go about the fact-checking process, because I do think it is important, and it can kind of get lost in the conversation sometimes. You know, people think about sort of fact-checking of politician statements, but not necessarily just the day-to-day fact-checking that is happening of the investigative reporting that we're doing.
Yeah, at this conference I recently sat in on, I went to a session on fact-checking, and it was called How to Sleep Better at Night. And I think that's so accurate in that it's a ton of extra work. I call myself neurotic because I read my stories a million times, even after they've been edited. But it helps me sleep at night thinking that I am glad I went back and triple checked it. And, you know, if I mess up, I mess up. But at least I tried really hard not to mess up.
Yeah, Josh, I don't know. Do you get those sort of 3 a.m. terrors sometimes where you're like, oh, I just need to make sure that name is spelled correctly again?
Oh, yeah. I mean, even when I do all the fact checking work, there's still after my story's published, usually, you know, these things are published in the morning. It's like, okay, we're in the window where if I screwed anything up, somebody will email me or call me. And then like after a certain amount of hours go by, I'm like, all right, I think I'm in the clear. Like, I think no one said anything. I mean, barely at this point. I mean, fingers crossed, like it doesn't happen very often, but I mean, just, you know, being a young reporter and like screwing up a name, like those are vivid memories, you know, of like pure panic, like, oh my God, I spelled, you know, I don't know, you know, whatever, with an I instead of a Y, or, you know. So yeah, no, it's terrifying. It's, yeah.
That time when you're just refreshing your email for about 2 hours after your story comes out.
Like, yeah. And then you see from a source and you're like, oh no, oh no. And then it's just like, nice story. And you're like, oh God. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what you want. That's what you want. No, and we, of course, you know, we'll correct a story, and people, you know, sometimes you have to issue a correction, and that happens. But we do, you know, we obviously want to do our best to check everything and triple check everything beforehand. Like Rose said, I used to print things out and cross them out like word by word and letter by letter for names to confirm that I had spelled things correctly. And I just had a very visual sense of what was needed to change or not. Well, I could talk about fact checking all day, but to go back to Rose's story. So I know you've spent a lot of time, you know, looking at these assisted living facilities, and what the story came out a couple weeks ago now. What has some of the response been to the story? What have you heard from people?
Yeah, I've heard, you know, we are the oldest state in the country by population, and we're just getting older. And so the demand for services is just going to grow. And so people are calling for an update to the regulations. It's time to kind of review how we are regulating residential care facilities. And part of the challenge is, you know, are the population in those facilities are much higher in medical needs than they were 20 years ago. And so a lot of the people I've talked to are calling for, it's time to look at these again and see if we need to increase the required staff ratios, increase the presence of things like registered nurses and maybe even physicians. And a big part of my recent story was training around dementia care. And so there's some required training for dementia care in residential care facilities that are licensed as memory care facilities, but not for all residential care across the board. And so some of the advocates I've talked to say we need training across the board. The population of people with dementia in this state is just projected to grow. So this will just become a bigger and bigger challenge. And the state is in the process now of a rulemaking process to update the regulations around all long-term care, but including residential care facilities. And I have a story that will be coming out soon, if not already, by the time this runs, that is in which the state talks about how elopement regulations could be part of that updated rulemaking process. So those conversations are ongoing and are slated to be put before the legislature in January.
Great. Yeah, I think you heard from the ombudsman, the person that's sort of top advocate for people in nursing homes and assisted living facilities, that she was actually surprised by the number of elopements, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's correct. She, they are not required to alert the ombudsman about elopements, but she does hear about them and from a number of different sources. The ombudsman office is the top advocate for residents in long-term care facilities and their families. And so she does hear about elopements, but she was surprised by the number that we reported in our story, and said that this rulemaking process will be a good opportunity to maybe review the current regulations and strengthen some of the requirements.
Great. Well, I know we're getting close to the top of the hour, and I just wanted to take a moment to highlight some of the other great reporting that the Monitor has done in the past month. I think I mentioned at the beginning, but I just wanted to go into it a bit more. Our reporter, Emily Bader, did a story about a recovery home in Machias that allows both women in recovery from substance use disorder plus their children to stay there while they're getting treatment services and all of that. And Emily went to Machias and talked to some of the current residents and some of the former residents and was able to really learn a lot about their stories. And, you know, one of the women, it's, you know, sort of a tragic tale where she had surgery and she was prescribed painkillers and then she got addicted, and she had been studying to be a nurse when that was the case, and her life sort of, you know, went down a different track after her addiction started. And she's now in this recovery home with her daughter and has been able to make a lot of progress there. And so I think I'd recommend that story to readers, because I think it really touches on a potential solution to what is a problem across the state. People can read the Maine Monitor's work at themainemonitor.org. It's free. There's no paywall. You can also sign up for any of our 5 free newsletters. We have one that's focused on Down East Maine. We have one focused on Western Maine, another focused on climate coverage. And then we have our Sunday, the Maine Monitor newsletter, which is where you can get our stories every week. You can also read them in the dailies across the state. The Press Herald and the Bangor Daily News often pick up our work, but you can always find them at themainemonitor.org.
This has been the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, a collaboration between WERU-FM and the Maine Monitor, the nonpartisan independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. Deputy Editor Stephanie McFeeters was joined today by reporters Josh Keefe and Rose Lundy. You can read their work, as they said, at themainemonitor.org and in newspapers across the state. Questions or comments related to the radio program can be sent to news@weru.org. The Maine Monitor Radio Hour is broadcast on the first Thursday of every month at 4 p.m. You can also listen on the WERU app, subscribe to the show as a podcast, or download archived shows at weru.org. For the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, I'm Amy Brown, and this is Community Radio WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill. Happy 4th of July!